Welcome to Harlow on Healthcare. I'm David Harlow, and I invite you to join me by my virtual hearth as I sit down with healthcare leaders to discuss building the future of healthcare. Today, my guest is Peter Newman. Peter is the director of the Center for the Evaluation of Value and Risk in Health and is a professor of medicine at the Tufts University School of Medicine. He is a member of the editorial advisory boards of Health Affairs and Value in Health and serves on many other advisory boards, including boards for the Congressional Budget Office and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Welcome, Peter, and thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, David. Glad to be here.
So for starters, I'd like to ask you for a short general introduction or definition of cost-effectiveness analysis.
Sure. So cost-effectiveness analysis is an analytic tool that helps us measure value. We apply it to healthcare. It can be applied to other areas as well. But the idea is that we can use cost-effectiveness analysis to better understand the clinical and economic consequences of different interventions in healthcare. It could be a drug, a device, a diagnostic test, a surgical procedure, or a public health program. We're trying to understand the costs, and by costs we usually mean costs broadly. That is, not only the cost of, the drug, but the cost of consequences of using the drug compared to, say, another drug or something else. Could be compared to exercise and diet, for example. And that's the numerator, the cost, and then the effectiveness is similarly trying to understand the health effects of using this intervention. Use this analytic tool to understand the costs and the health effects. And the cost per unit of health effect, say the cost per life year gained with a new drug, is one way of measuring the value of that drug.
So you used the word value, Peter, and that to me connects with the notion of value-based payment, which is obviously a key issue in healthcare discussions today. So is there a nexus between the work that you're doing on cost effectiveness and the policy and business decisions in the healthcare marketplace generally in the context of value-based payment for healthcare services?
Right. Well, everybody wants to obtain better value for our spending, and value-based payment approaches are ways to do just that. We're trying to implement programs in hospitals and clinics and elsewhere to try to tie payment mechanisms to achieving better value, achieving better outcomes for patients, for example. But value-based payment approaches beg questions about how you measure value. How do we know that the new payment system achieves better value? How do we know, for that matter, whether any new intervention achieves better value? So that's where cost-effectiveness analysis can come in to serve as a measurement tool to provide a framework to measure value. And again, there are different ways of doing this, but typically we're trying to measure the costs and trying to measure the health benefits. And in this cost-effectiveness analysis, we combine costs and health benefits into, you know, often a single metric, a cost-effectiveness ratio. So decision makers, whether they're policymakers or businesses, are implementing strategies to get better value in healthcare. And cost-effectiveness analysis might be seen as the analytic tool to help us measure whether that value is being achieved.
Ryan, so I know you've written about this a lot in the context of pharma, cost-effectiveness of drug therapies. And I'd like to talk about that a little bit and see if we can generalize to healthcare more broadly. So just as an example, you've recently written about looking at value assessments of drug therapy and then raise the question of whether that calculus does or should vary based on the population being treated. So that's one of the inputs into the calculation that's being performed. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Sure. So there's this important question about whether a new drug, say for cancer or multiple sclerosis or for a rare pediatric condition, or any disease for that matter, achieves value, whatever value means, and that's what we'll talk about. But the idea is, does the new drug's price, and for some of these new drugs, as you well know, the price is quite high. Some of these new cancer drugs, it's $100,000 a year. Some of the new rare disease drugs, it's many hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. So how do we think about whether that price is reflective of value? So we might do a cost-effectiveness analysis, and we might do a cost-effectiveness analysis across a range of drugs for a range of different populations and diseases. And ideally, these cost-effectiveness analyses are done with a standard metric that can be used to compare across diseases and populations. A favored standard metric for economists is something called the cost per quality-adjusted life year gained, or QALY. Now, we can, in theory, calculate a cost per QALY for all these different drugs. We can have a cost per QALY for the cancer drug, for the drug for MS, for the drug for the rare disease. And then the interesting question, the important question becomes, should some diseases, say cancer, or some populations, say children, warrant an even higher cost-effectiveness ratio? Another way to think about it, should some of these conditions and populations deserve a higher drug price? Not so much necessarily because of the health benefits achieved, that's certainly part of it, but by nature of the, or by virtue of the disease or population itself. Are we willing to pay more for drugs for cancer than drugs for non-cancer conditions? Even if the health benefits, say, measured as life expectancy or quality-adjusted life expectancy is the same. This is a challenging question. Some people believe that we should, that we're willing to pay more for cancer. We're willing to pay more for, say, children. We're willing to pay more for vulnerable populations. We're willing to pay more, say, for people at the end of life or people who are facing life-threatening conditions. On the other hand, a case can be made that we shouldn't override cost-effectiveness criteria simply because the disease is rare or because the disease is cancer, that doing so would sacrifice overall population health. And so these debates go on, and in a way, they're at the heart of a lot of the national discussion about when a drug price is appropriate or fair.
Right, but identifying these inputs, I guess, makes explicit the policy decisions that have to be made, as opposed to saying, well, this is a $100,000 drug, this is a $200,000 drug. Is that right? Is that price appropriate? Sort of appropriate based on what? Appropriate compared to what? Is this something that could be administered to a child and thereby ensure many years of disease-free life, as opposed to sort of end-of-life treatment, sort of that whole discussion of who or what kinds of patients should be the targets of the therapies, of the expenditures for these therapies?
No, that's right. I mean, the new drugs that are coming along in many cases are effective and powerful and in demand. We've seen new drugs for leukemia, for example, that are new drugs for rare genetic disorders with very, very high price tags. How should we think about whether those price tags are appropriate, commensurate with value? That's a hard question. One starting point for thinking about the question is to calculate these cost-effectiveness ratios. And the idea is that if we have these cost-effectiveness ratios, it gives us a common currency to compare a drug for leukemia with a drug for rare disease, with a drug for migraine and so forth. It's a way of thinking about what we're getting for our spending using a common metric. So in that sense, it's a powerful construct or concept or tool. And it's important, again, to emphasize this is a starting point for these very difficult conversations.
Sure. So how does this key in to the broader discussion of looking at value-based care or value-based analyses of therapies and trying to give payers and providers the analytical tools they need to use in planning or pricing or purchasing or delivering care? I mean, I think you've alluded recently to one such attempt, if you will, which is a cost-effectiveness-based formulary development tool being used by one of the large pharmacy benefit managers. Is that
right? So
these are useful building blocks to go into that development, but I hear you saying that there are other policy or business considerations that need to be entered into the calculus as well.
Right. So imagine an expensive new therapy comes along and it's $1 million. And we have some data on the clinical benefits, and and there's uncertainty about exactly in whom the drug may work or whether it would work or how long it will work. But we have some information about the costs and about the benefits. The health plan or the payer is faced with a decision. Should they cover the new therapy in their formulary with their health plan, and how much should they pay? The drug company is charging $1 million. Is $1 million a price that's worthwhile? You know, in a way, should it be less? Should it be higher? Of course, the payer would like to pay as little as they can. But let's say it's $1 million, and they're trying to understand, you know, whether this is good value. The cost effectiveness ratio, the cost per quality adjusted life year that's produced, is, as I mentioned, a starting point for helping them think about that. And the cost per quality ratio is an input, and it's one input into the payer's decision about how they might negotiate the price. Let's say the cost per quality ratio is relatively unfavorable because the $1 million is producing relatively small benefits. That would be an argument for the health plan to try to negotiate the price down, to try to restrict the price. On the other hand, it could be that the $1 million is producing a large degree of benefits, and that's an input into a decision about restrictions and pricing as well. And again, these are the cost-effectiveness ratio is just one input into this. Other factors that matter for the payer will be, is there an alternative to this therapy that they might give patients? What kinds of new studies are being done by the drug company to bring new evidence, and can the payer wait for some of the new evidence, and other factors that go into this? So, the idea is we all want to get better value for our money, and the cost effectiveness analysis is another piece of evidence. I think that's the best way to think about it. Another piece of evidence on what we're getting for what we're spending.
If you're just tuning in, this is Harlow on Healthcare, coming to you on Healthcare Now Radio. I'm David Harlow, and my guest is Peter Newman, Director of the Center for the Evaluation of Value and Risk in Health at Tufts Medical Center. Peter, your comment about the potential value of alternative treatments, I think, is an important one. And obviously, we're not looking at each particular treatment or therapy in a vacuum in doing this sort of evaluation. You recently wrote about the second U.S. panel on cost effectiveness in health and medicine in a paper published recently, and on future directions for cost effectiveness research. And you focused in that paper on some recommended areas for future work. I'd be interested if you could share with us some information about this second panel, why it was convened?
Sure. The second panel on cost effectiveness in health and medicine is an update to the original panel, which was a set of national guidelines and recommendations for conducting cost effectiveness analyses. And the idea was for the first panel, which came out about 20 years ago, that there was a need for a report on the state of the field and recommendations for those who would conduct and use cost effectiveness analyses. So it's been 20 years since that original panel, and a second panel was convened, and I was part of the second panel. And we updated the guidelines and provided a revised set of recommendations for the field. So the recommendations came out in a paper in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 2006 and a book published in late 2006 with all of the recommendations revised.
And recently, I know that you were involved in a new paper looking at some specific research recommendations in order to further this sort of work. One area that was very interesting to me was the notion that we should be looking at health effects on caregivers of patients as part of the calculus. And maybe that's something that wasn't included in the framework 20 years ago?
Right. This is a long-standing issue, and it was certainly touched upon in the first panel, but I think a lot of research has been done, and we expanded and thought a bit more about these recommendations. But the idea is, if we really want to measure the value of a new therapy or any intervention for that matter, the patient, of course, is the primary recipient and consumer and the audience who receives the value, but that there are other important audiences as well, caregivers, for example, being a particularly important one. If you treat the patient with, say, a substance abuse disorder, and that patient is managed well, obviously the patient benefits, but the caregivers benefit a lot. The families of that patient benefit a lot. Society benefits. And so the idea is, if we really want to capture value, we should be thinking more broadly about the audience, not only the patient, but the caregivers, the families, society. And in a kind of similar way, there may be other sectors beyond healthcare that benefit, that we might want to think about it, and in fact try to quantify. For example, if you staying with the substance abuse disorder example, if the patient is managed, treated, there may be reductions in, say, crime. There may be gains to productivity as that person goes back to work. Those are things that we, in theory, could quantify and measure. Traditionally, we haven't done that or haven't done it consistently. But in the revised guidelines, we have some new recommendations on that. And it's certainly an area for additional research going forward.
Sure. In the opioid epidemic arena, I know each state is sort of going down its own path in addressing the situation, and some states are more focused on criminal enforcement, and others are more focused on treatment and rehabilitation. And I think that's sort of an interesting ready-made series of data that can be looked at in terms of reviewing the effectiveness of the approaches of the various states over time.
Right, and the cost effectiveness, ideally, that imagine the elected officials, the policymakers, thinking about a series of choices to deal with the opioid problem, criminal justice strategies, treatment strategies. It brings us back to why we do cost effectiveness analyses. We don't have the resources to do everything. We have to make choices. We'd like to get the most benefit for the policy choices that we do make. And the cost effectiveness analysis is trying to help us think about what are the costs and what are the benefits of the different strategies. So in theory and even in practice, we could do some analysis of the various options available and then try to understand the cost and the benefits. And again, this is where it gets important to measure value broadly, because some of the benefits may be non-traditional ones that are not even in the health sector, but still important for the policymakers to know about. So it's that kind of research that the second panel had in mind as we wrote these recommendations and wrote this paper about future directions.
Right. So I imagine while there may be some general areas of agreement in how to value certain inputs and outputs, there may be less agreement in how to value non-health specific outcomes?
I think that's right, that these non-specific outcomes tend to be harder to measure because the data, for example, are not as readily available. And we're trying to trace out the ripples in the pond when you throw the stone, in a sense. And the farther the ripples go out, and you could argue some of these non-health benefits are those kinds of more distal ripples, they get a bit harder to trace, and there's more uncertainty in the quantification. But still important, and this is likely to be an ongoing challenge for the field, but still one that I'd argue we need to do a better job at quantifying.
Sure. One line that jumped out at me was an observation that the QALY model is indifferent to the sequence of events and weights health states proportional to their duration, which obviously is not necessarily the way a human being would evaluate or weight the same sorts of information. I'm wondering if you have thoughts about how we can get past that limitation, or is that just sort of part of the landscape in doing this sort of analysis?
So these are good questions that, you know, raise lots of issues. The quality-adjusted life year, the QALY, is a health metric. It's a way of trying to quantify gains in health that combines life expectancy and quality of life changes in a single number. And when you do that, you are relying on some strong assumptions. For example, that the sequence you mentioned, the sequence of events don't matter. That is to say, whether I have the severe phase first or later, it's just the QALY is just going to capture the time in the severe stage and try to adjust for the quality of life during that time. But people care about such things. People may care about the order in which events happen. They may care a lot about not just how long they're going to live, but what is the probability that they'll live until their son or daughter gets married or some other event takes place. That might be very important to them. Patients differ very much in how they care about such things. Of course, they do. The QALY doesn't always, in fact, doesn't capture the richness of patient preferences about treatments, about side effects, about how a drug is administered, about whether it's at home or, say, in a clinic, and on and on. The QALY can't possibly capture all of that complexity. But I think the best way to think about it is the QALY is an input into a difficult decision, and it's an important input. It's a starting point. It allows us to compare diverse things and gives us a way of thinking about what we're getting for what we're spending. But that all of these other things that people care about matter a lot. We should try to marshal information about those things and use all of that information when we make decisions.
Of course. That's quite a challenge. And it sounds like you are continually identifying new areas of inquiry in order to build out models with greater accuracy or sensitivity to different sorts of issues.
Right. There's a series of technical issues as we do these analyses. We try to be as objective and scientific as possible, and then provide input into the policymakers' decisions, the clinical decisions, the government business decisions. And those decisions are always challenging. We, as analysts, have to do this with, you know, the idea that we're trying to be technically as sound as we can, but we also have, I think, to have some humility about, you know, our ability to do it well. And part of what we're doing is trying to characterize the uncertainty around the decisions, but also recognize that at the end of the day, there are patients, doctors and patients making decisions, and patients making decisions about their own health. Those are very, very difficult. Resources are scarce. We can't do everything that we would want to do for everyone. And so cost-effectiveness analysis helps us get the most health for the spend that we can, alongside a lot of other considerations.
Yes. So, Peter, let me give you my last question, and that's this. If you were to wake up tomorrow and find yourself 5 years in the future, what is one thing in healthcare that you would hope or expect to find has changed drastically?
Well, I would hope that we could improve on the health metrics that we look at. I would hope we'd have better population health. We measure that in lots of ways: life expectancy and infant mortality and number of people with obesity and diabetes, and lots of other ways we measure it. That would be my number one hope, that we improve population health. I would also hope we would do so without spending more of our income, national income, on healthcare, because we know there's a lot of waste and inefficiencies in the system. And through payment changes, through better financing and delivery, and a whole host of other things, I think it's possible. It'll be hard to do it, but I think we would ideally, in 5 years, have better health, and we're not spending more of our income to do so.
I certainly hope so. We seem to continue that inexorable march on 20% of GDP spend on healthcare. And that seems to me like a red line that we shouldn't cross.
Right. And of course, there's no magic number. It's not clear what the right number should be. But certainly, if we believe, and a lot of evidence to support it, that we're just doing things inefficiently compared to what other countries achieve for their spend, and compared to other ways of thinking about this, that we should be able to do better.
Yes, we should. Well, Peter, thank you very much for joining me. I appreciate your taking the time.
Well, thank you, David. Great to talk to you.
You have been listening to Harlow on Healthcare. Join us at healthcarenowradio.com. Let's continue the conversation on building the future of healthcare together at #HarlowOnHC. I'm David Harlow, keeping the fire going and holding a seat open for you. Until next time.